Hunter forgets sometimes that I get the last mic. This morning after class, he said, see if you can follow that one up, Dad. So we're going to give it a shot. Joke's on him. I forgot to record his class. So, and Bruce, I'm sorry, Oklahoma song leaders, we leave pages out just to keep you on your toes. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 23 this morning.
Good to see some faces that I haven't seen in a while, for sure. Good to see you that came here this morning. Again, good to have you here.
Yeah, we've been talking over the last... Let's see if that's better. Is that better? All right. We've been talking over the last several months about the church, but doing it from a different perspective, taking it out of the gospel. And we've kind of gone through some of the parables, and it's given us some... To me, it's helped me see God differently. It's helped me see church differently. Because we're not really... the end goal. Everybody wants to know the end goal. The end goal isn't to be a part of the church. The end goal is to be a part of the kingdom. And so, if we spend more time focusing on the kingdom, church becomes natural. And so, in that, I want us to share in that perspective. We're going to get into something that's a little bit negative today, so I'll try to smile when I say it, but I'm not going to soften it. How's that? In Matthew chapter 23, I want to read the very first verse of this chapter. The first couple verses here, and then we're going to skip to verse 13. But then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, so do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do, for they preach, but they do not practice." And so here I've told you guys I've enjoyed watching The Chosen and being able to put some visual behind some of the events during Jesus' ministry. And this is kind of one of those events where you see this conflict building and growing through Jesus' ministry between the Pharisees and the scribes and him. And as he gets to this section, I want you to understand there's been a few things that have already happened, that have already taken place. One of which, he's had the triumphant entry. He's cleansed the temple. And in that, there's a perspective, right? There's a perspective that things look good on the outside, but they're just horribly wrong on the inside. The temple looked good in the car business. I was in Vegas and went to 4 auctions this week. And the first thing I do when I go to a car auction is the auctions have the inventory listed out. So I've got an app on my phone. It's called AutoNeek. I can click Mannheim Auto Auction and I can see the cars that are fixing to run at that auction. And I can look through there and I go, "Oh, I like that one. Ooh, I like that one." And so I create a list of cars that I want to look at when my feet hit the ground so that I'm saving time. And it's interesting to me that my list might be 30 or 40 cars at an auction. But by the time I look at the cars, that list gets shrunk down 2/3. Because the presentation on a list, they look good, but the reality is when you get up to them, they don't look so good anymore. Right? And it's interesting that auctions now do condition reports. I don't believe them. All right, so the condition report them on a scale of 0 or 1 to 5. 5 being, man, this car's perfect, and then everything in between. I've seen cars with 4.2 credit, condition reports that look like they belong in a salvage yard. So it's one person's perspective of this car. But oftentimes when I see a car at 50 feet, that car looks really good. Y'all ever experience that? Or maybe it's got the camera side. I like that too. I actually, one of the very first cars I ever bought at an auction, I was 22 years old, right about 22 years old. My dad sent me to Albuquerque Auto Auction. I was so excited, but super nervous at the same time. And there was a 1992 or 3 Dodge Shadow. And I had looked at this car and everything was, seemed right, seemed good. And so the car, it comes onto the auction block and I'm being very intentional with how I bid, and I'm nervous, and I buy this car, and I'm so excited that I bought this car. And right after I purchased the car, a gentleman walks up to me who I don't know, and he goes, "Hey, if you need that passenger door, let me know. I have one." I'm like, uh-oh. What'd I miss? And so now I'm nervous. And so I leave the auction and I walk out to the lot where that car gets parked. And I walk up to it and I walk around it and I'm like, man, nothing wrong with that door. That guy was just messing with me. That door looks perfect. And I reached and opened the door and it fell off. It hit the ground. The hinges weren't even connected. And I was like, oh boy, Dad's going to love me for this one. But oftentimes, isn't it interesting how something looks right, but it's just not. And when Jesus comes and cleanses the temple, that's exactly what he's doing. He's saying, listen, from the outside, from 50 feet, man, everything in the temple looks good. But when you get down into the heart and to the innards of the temple, everything's wrong. And so he's fixing to give some woes here. All right? And if I titled this lesson, I would say, woe. But I want to change it a little bit because it says, woe to the Pharisees and to the scribes. But interestingly enough, in the very first verse of this chapter, it doesn't appear that the Pharisees are part of this audience. Now, there may be some there, but it specifically said that he's speaking to the crowd and to his disciples. The Pharisees are already frustrated with him. He's already been locking horns with them. So they're in the shadows, if you will, conspiring to kill Jesus. And so there's probably Pharisees here, but they're not specifically mentioned as part of the audience. So it begs the question, when he's giving these woes to his disciples, why doesn't it say he's addressing the Pharisees? So I want to change the verbiage a little bit. This morning, instead of it being woe to the Pharisees and to the scribes, I want it to say woe to the Christians. Woe to the Christians. Because, again, I believe that the Bible is timeless. It speaks to us today. And so what is Jesus telling us today? And so let's read this. Let's be more intentional with how we read this text this morning. Let's be intentional with the reality that he's speaking to us. And let's see what God has to tell us through his Son, Jesus Christ. Flip to verse 13. I want to read through this, and then we'll break it down a little bit. But woe to you... I'm going to switch it so y'all know. But woe to you Christians, hypocrites, for you have shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. For you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter in. Woe to you Christians, you hypocrites, for you travel across the sea and land to make a single proselyte, but when you become a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves. Woe to you Christians, blind guides, who say if anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing, but if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools. For which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men. For which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? So whoever swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. Woe to you Christians, hypocrites. For you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel. Woe to you Christians, for you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Christians, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside also may be clean. Woe to you Christians, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanliness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you Christians, you hypocrites. You build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, if we had lived in those days, the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part in them, shedding the blood of the prophets. Thus you witness against yourself that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your fathers, your servants, you brood of vipers.
How are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous bloodshed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah to the son of Barakiah, whom you have murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. That's kind of heavy, isn't it, when you hear it? But as I spent some time looking at this text, I want to challenge us to understand that, and it's stuff we know, but it's still stuff we still struggle with. God, we know that God's desire is for our heart, but yet we have figured out how to outwardly act. So that we're more present, so that people see us in a light. You know, it's interesting to me, social media has become this big picture of who you're really not, but who you're trying to present yourself to be. You know what saddens me the most about social media? Is it's a page out of the church's book. Let me say that again. It's a page out of the church's book. Because for generations and generations, from the time of Jesus' ministry, we've been doing this. We've been presenting ourselves in one light and living in another light. And so let me challenge us this morning with three points that I think Jesus is trying to make. The first is to be a door opener instead of a door closer. He criticizes the Pharisees and saying, listen, you've shut the door because you're not accessing the throne room of God anymore. Everything that you do is purely for your righteousness, has nothing to do with what God's intention for your life is to be. And so you're closing the door, and not only are you closing the door and slamming it in people's face because they can't act like you, they can't be like you, they can't follow the law like you do, because the law has become your God. And so if Jesus was here talking to us today, he might ask, who is your God? Is it me or is it the law? Because oftentimes we forget who we are worshiping. We worship the ability and the desire to follow the law. Anybody in here want to be a good law follower? One. Wow, I was not expecting that. I figured some more hands would come up on that. All right. Anybody speed on their way to church? Yeah, nobody. Hey, I appreciate your honesty on that, right? Who owns a radar detector? I have three. All right, so it's like we understand it, but then the reality is, it's like, it's not super important, but the reality is, God's saying, who's going to be your God? And to the Pharisees, what he's addressing here, Jesus is frustrated in this moment because these people are attacking the messenger. He gets to that at the very end of the woes. And what they're not understanding or what they're not seeing is that they have become puppets of the law. Yeah, Paul even says, to the law, I was blameless. Think about that for a second. These people kept the law really well. I'm not going to take that away from them. These guys were really good law keepers. Really good law keepers. But they did it for the benefit of themselves. And so Jesus goes on to say, not only are you closing the door, but you'll cross land and sea to convert someone over to your way of thinking. And let me challenge you with this, because I think this is important. Who are we inviting people to? What are we inviting people to? This has been a struggle and a soapbox thing for me for a long, long time. It's so often that we invite people to a church instead of inviting people to a Savior. And the difference is, when we invite them to church, we're teaching them how to do church. We're teaching them how to follow the rules. We're not teaching them how to fall in love with a Savior that is merciful, that is gracious, that is righteous. And so he's saying, man, you're converting them over to being law followers. And this is what I know about converts. It used to frustrate me as a kid. I used to hear this as a kid. A person who didn't grow up in the church but came to know Christ much later in life is typically a more passionate,
Christian because they know what it's like to be lost. Has anybody ever heard that? Well, for me growing up in the church, it just frustrated me. I'm like, what do you mean? They got more passion than I do? Come on. But this is exactly what Jesus is talking about here. He said, you have created these people who are now in your care and they're following you. And they've given up maybe Gentile and they've converted into Judaism. In that conversion, they had to say, everything that's in my past is gone. And so you've created someone that's going to be twice as hard for them to fall in love with me. Because they sold everything out to follow you. And so not only are you creating this dynamic in who you are and what you represent, you're creating a following of people who are missing the most important thing. Righteousness comes through Jesus Christ. Who we serve is God, not the law. And so the first point this morning, sorry my iPad shut down, is be door openers. So ask yourself this question. Are you a door or are you a roadblock? Are you a door or are you a roadblock? The second thing I want to mention out of this text, years ago, I grew up in New Mexico, back when UNM basketball program was good. It's been a long time. I mean, they weren't ever great, but they were good. Back in Luke Longley's day, and there were some good players back in there. But the coach was named Dave Bliss. Dave Bliss said something one time that stuck with me. I was a teenager when he said this. He said, keep the main thing the main thing. And so the second point I want to bring out of this is kind of a Dave Bliss quote. Keep the main thing the main thing. Major in the major things, not the minor things. Because oftentimes we get caught up and we spend a tremendous amount of effort, energy, and time majoring on the minor things. They're sitting there, the Pharisees and the scribes are sitting there contemplating, hey, if I'm drinking my drink and I swallow a gnat, is it unclean? Because winged things are unclean. Now, that doesn't make sense to us in today's society, right? Let me just rephrase it a little bit differently. If we don't have an opening prayer, is that a problem? Or if we do this or don't do that, or if we do this or maybe we avoid that, we spend a tremendous amount of time contemplating the minor things of life. And we get sucked into it. That's what I love about this presentation of saying, what's a church supposed to look like? And it's been kind of fun but hard to just take this idea from the Gospels. Because oftentimes we get caught up in the letters, right? And Paul, and he's addressing specific churches and saying, man, you don't need to do this. But to one church he's saying this thing, and to another church he's saying this thing, and it's confusing. And we spend a tremendous amount of time trying to figure out what he's saying. Or is that just me? You're smiling. Because we spend a ton of time trying to figure out, well, he said this to the church in Corinth. He said this to the church in Galatia. And there's a little bit of differences there. Maybe could it be that the church in Galatia needed something different than the church in Corinth? Maybe they were dealing with something in their community that was different. Or maybe the community in Bayfield, right, is a little bit different than the community in Lubbock or Merkel. And maybe we need something a little bit different. And we could spend a ton of time trying to figure out what this congregation needs, what that congregation needs, what would be applicable, what would not be applicable. But one thing I do know, without a shadow of a doubt, is whether you're in Merkel, Oklahoma, or Bayfield, Colorado, every one of these churches need Jesus. And if we're gonna major in something, right? If we're going to major in something, if you've ever been to church in a foreign country, you've probably been uncomfortable. If you've ever been in church in Arkansas, you've probably been uncomfortable, right? Because I can remember the first time I went to a Church of Christ in Arkansas, and it was uncomfortable, right? It's not how I was raised. And so it begs the question, why is that Church of Christ different than this Church of Christ? Well, I'm getting caught up in the minors instead of the majors. And so Jesus is purely telling the Pharisees and the scribes, listen, you've been caught up in trying to figure out, what am I supposed to tithe? Is it just in these things, or is it in these things? Is it just in this or is it just in that? And they're spending all of this time trying to do something that I like calling trying to find a loophole. Trying to find a loophole. Because the first thing they haven't already recognized is that everything they have belongs to God. So shouldn't God have all of it anyway? Instead, we're spending a lot of time trying to determine what fits into tithing and what doesn't fit into tithing. They're focusing on the minors instead of the major. And the whole time they're spending time trying to become righteousness, trying to become the best law follower, they have forgotten the majors. Forgiveness. Mercy. Grace. They've forgotten all the things that truly have value because they've spent all of their time addressing the things that really shouldn't matter that much if God's got you. If God's got you, He wants all of you. Mary Crowley, years and years and years ago, I'm getting old, I've figured that out over the last few weeks, said, how much of God do you want? Just enough to save you? Or do you want Him to change you? And oftentimes I think we find ourselves in the camp of, oh dear God, save me, but please don't change me. So in this moment, Jesus is trying to address an issue. And what I want you to see, and that's why I started in verse 1, he's really talking to His disciples in this message. And don't get me wrong, I think there probably are some Pharisees there, but He's addressing His disciples because He's addressing the next group of leadership for Him. And in this next group of leadership, He's trying to say, don't do this. Don't major in the minor things of life. Major in the redemption of who I am. And so I'm going to take a step back and say, Church of Christ in Bayfield, Colorado, what are we going to major in? Doing it all right? Or falling in love with Jesus? Because there's a difference. And the representation of that is difference. Is the difference. And the last thing, the last point, is are you being a blessing to your spiritual leaders? You know, the Pharisees had said, hey man, we're building these shrines and these monuments to the prophets. And if we had lived in those times, how many times you all asked yourself that question? If you'd have lived in Jesus' times, who would you have been? Which character would you have been? We all like to think we would have been the sons of thunder, right? But the reality is some of us might have been Judas. And so oftentimes we put ourselves back in that place and say, who would we have been? And so that's exactly what the Pharisees have done. If we would have been back in our ancestors' days, in our fathers' days, we wouldn't have murdered the prophets. We would have honored the prophets. The whole time that they're saying that, they're plotting behind the scenes to kill the Messiah. Think about that for a second. On one hand, they're saying, we would have honored Him, we wouldn't have killed them. But they're not honoring the Son of God. They're plotting to kill Him. So my challenge for us this morning is to quit looking backwards. That's hard for me to do. I've thought many times I was born in the wrong era. I thought I should have been back in the old West where I could have carried a sidearm and shot somebody who didn't like me. I'm joking a little, right? But the reality is we spend time longing for what used to be instead of pressing forward for what is. Jesus is talking to a very dark time in Jewish history where they have so forgotten the purpose. They've so forgotten the lineage. They have become masters at being self-righteous. They've become so good at it that it's alienated the people that they should have been ministering to because they look right and they were honored in their time. They were honored for being these law-abiding people, and it carried great weight and great compassion. But what it created also was a separation, because people, the average guy, couldn't look and say, "I need to find God." And they this is what they would tell them. Y'all hear me on this. If you get these things right, you'll find him. What do we tell people today? If they want to find God, show them God. If they want to find relationship with God, show them Christ. It's all about relationship. It's all about relationship with Jesus Christ. Because in that relationship, we gain the Holy Spirit and access to God. Major in the major things. Don't be a roadblock, be a door. Door to what? Not the church, to Christ Jesus. Show the Savior. Show the Messiah. Don't claim righteousness on your own merit and your own ability to do all the right things. Show righteousness because you have allowed Jesus Christ to sit on your heart. He's saying, listen, if you're going to swear an oath, are you swearing an oath on the gold that's in the temple? Or on the temple where God sits? What are you swearing an oath on the altar or the things around the altar? Listen, I need you to understand, it's never been about you. I appreciate y'all, but it's never been about you. It's always been about him. And the more we try to alienate this idea that it's these things over here and then it's God, the more we're missing what God intended for his children, which is a desired relationship with them. Everything from the Old Testament pushing forward to this pivotal point has pointed towards a relationship with the Messiah equals. It's not greater than or less than. That's a math equation, in case y'all are wondering. Relationship with Jesus Christ equals relationship with God. So I want to end with a question. Who do you want relationship with? The church or God? Because sometimes if you choose the church, that's what you'll have, a relationship with the church. But if you choose God, you get them both. You get them both. Y'all hear that? You get them both. Isn't it cool that we can make one choice and get it all? Or we can sit here and make a bunch of individual choices and possibly miss the biggest one. So let me challenge y'all this morning. Who do you want a relationship with? I choose Jesus Christ. I choose Jesus Christ and him crucified. Because in that relationship, in the totality of who Jesus was, And I love that picture, because Jesus was the totality of sacrifice. He was the totality of the law. He was totality of righteousness. He was the totality of everything. And so I don't have to choose the law. I don't have to choose righteousness. I don't have to choose this. I don't have to choose that. I get to make one choice, and if I choose him, I get all of it. Anybody else tired of making all these choices? Let's simplify it to one. I choose Jesus. Because in Jesus, I get sacrifice. In Jesus, I get righteousness. In Jesus, I get the law. In Jesus, I get relationship with God. Y'all are quiet this morning. Even Brooks fell asleep. Man, I got to work on that. Maybe you're right, Hunter. Maybe yours was better than mine this morning. Hey, thank y'all for giving me the chance to speak so passionately about something I love, which is Jesus and him crucified. But this morning, I want to challenge y'all. If Jesus hasn't been your choice, if all these other choices have taken precedence in your life, I want to challenge y'all this morning to choose one thing, and in that one thing, you're going to get the rest of it. And the rest of it sometimes might look imperfect, because anybody in here imperfect? It may not look right. It frustrates me a lot to hear people leaving the church because the church did them wrong. What do you expect? The church is going to do some people wrong. Jesus isn't. Choose Jesus. It'll keep you plugged in at church. You choose the church. So the only thing that can keep you plugged in is if the church is doing what you want it to do. But if you choose Jesus, you get the church in its beauty. Doesn't mean there's not frustration, but it means I see Jesus. If there's anything that we can do for you this morning, whether it's to give your life to Christ through baptism, or just reset your mind, or if you need prayers of this congregation, I challenge you to come as Bruce leads us in an invitation song.